Capital Region, this is Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOCLP 105.3 FM, Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM, Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM, Albany, and WCAALP 107.3 FM, Albany, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
And I'm Gabe.
And I'm Bria Barthel, and my debut as co-host. Today, we begin with Paul Smart reporting on Wednesday's rallies in Albany in response to the killing of Dante Wright in Minnesota.
Then, Willie Terry speaks with labor organizer and activist Art Fleischner about the history of May Day in the Capital Region.
Later on, Zena Basile-Hickey met with Amy Klein of Capital Roots to talk about her presentation at the upcoming Sustainable Futures Conference.
After that, we hear from another speaker at the Sustainable Futures Conference, climate activist and student Melissa Hoffman, who spoke with the Sanctuary's Water Justice Fellows.
Finally, we hear about an event taking place this weekend, Flowers for Black Lives. Melissa Brownlee gets the details from organizers Amani Ulagbela and Angela Belor. But first, some headlines.
The Schenectady School District would add $3.6 million in new programs and services under a first draft of the tentative full $236.5 million general fund budget that leaders are planning for the next school year. The proposal would keep school taxes within the state tax cap. The Times Union reports that a major reason for the stable tax situation is that the district will receive $10.8 million more from the state for pre-K programs than it got for the current school year. The district overall will receive $150 million in state aid.
The Gazette reports that the Schenectady City School Board started its search for a new superintendent once again on Wednesday night, after the previous finalist for the position withdrew. The board is still debating the merits between an open versus closed search process, a decision it struggled with a year ago. The NAACP withdrew from the initial process after the board only presented one finalist for community input.
The Times Union reports that the demand to buy a house in the Capital District is greater than the supply, forcing many buyers to make bids higher than the asking price. Even with the higher bids, many buyers lose out. New listings have fallen 25% since February.
The Times Union also reports that more than 50 individuals on Wednesday joined a peaceful rally at Townsend Park in Albany to protest police brutality and the killing of Dante Wright, the Minnesota man gunned down Sunday by a police officer during a traffic stop. Later that evening, some residents clashed with police outside the police station in the South End, with police using pepper spray on the crowd.
The Record reports that Cohoes Mayor Bill Keeler is seeking common council approval for a $6.6 million historic cleaner, greener Cohoes bond. Projects include converting the city's 1,598 streetlights to energy-efficient light-emitting diode or LED bulbs with smart lighting infrastructure, upgrading the city's parks over 3 years, and energy savings upgrades to city-owned buildings. The various energy upgrades will save the city money in the long run. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or follow us on Instagram or Twitter at Media Sanctuary and on Facebook at facebook.com/Media Sanctuary.
On Wednesday evening, April 14th, in Albany's South End, Hudson Mohawk Magazine reporter Paul Smart was at a police protest for what appears to be the first of a long season of tense interactions ahead.
Yeah, go back inside, yo.
A peaceful protest against the recent murder of Dante Wright by police in Minnesota marched downtown in Albany on Wednesday afternoon, April 14th. It ended up running into a wall of belligerent Albany police in front of their South Precinct house on Arch Street. We were there as a standoff ensued. Police stood on a ramp at the station's entranceway. Protesters tended to those who had been pepper sprayed or manhandled by officers. The mood was tense, reminiscent of last year following the murder of George Floyd.
Actually, right here, just right here, the officer comes over and takes my he literally took my this officer right here in the white, took my blowhorn and pushed and then it right in my face. And honestly, my upper lip is not attached right now, currently to
you can actually see
my
blood
lip
on his mask if you look.
And on that officer, there's my blood is all over his mask. Yeah. That officer has my blood on his mask over there. And currently, my upper lip is not attached.
And then the action started afternoon here?
It started, honestly, we were 3 p.m., but we didn't really start, like, moving, I think, until probably, like, maybe closer to 4:30, almost 5. And then we got down here. And him, per usual, was ready for a fight from the jump. And, you know, he was ready for a confrontation. And, yeah. And he, you know, came out. He pepper sprayed her multiple times. There's a man that's all the way down there that was pushed to the ground, pepper sprayed several times. There's another black woman that was pushed down.
Someone carried me out.
So many, like, people were pepper sprayed in their mouths. There's another person that was also assaulted by him as well. He, like, took, they had a light in their hand. He took it and, like, you know, he's just...
Are they saying anything before?
No. They're just, you know, they're just ready. They just, they're literally just coming down and just spraying people, and we have it all on video. It's absolutely disgusting, and at the end of the day, what are, like, we're sitting here against police brutality, and you're sitting here brutalizing us.
What's going on? Spray. I'll spray. Yeah, spray that shit in my mouth.
That doesn't make any sense.
Should burn for a minute.
The sequence was that everybody was just walking up to protest, and it's happening around the country and everywhere, and they came out to meet you all? Or?
Yeah, they were already standing
outside. They were already standing outside, waiting.
Yeah.
I think they pretty much already knew, because each place that we went, there was, like, you know what I mean, officers either trying to follow us or, like, waiting at each intersection.
And where did you start?
We started at Townsend Park.
Okay.
And we went up. And like I said, we just came over up here. This was our end point, and to end the protest here. And they were already waiting for us. We kind of knew that they were going to be in riot gear, already prepared for us or whatever. But, you know, we didn't know what they were, you know, what exactly they were going to have prepared. But we didn't know that they were going to be ready to full on, like, assault us, like, with our own, you know, megaphones and whatnot. So. And then not only that, they were, like, bum-rushing, like I said, females, like, and femmes, and
all we were doing was standing on the ramp. That's literally it.
This has all come about as the city wrestles with new legislation to demilitarize policing and ban the use of tear gas. Further protests are expected over the coming days and weeks. We later left as the police moved inside their precinct house and the protesters argued among themselves, then marched back up the hill towards Lark Street, police cruisers stopping traffic along the way. It appears that we're going to have a long spring and hot summer. This has been Paul Smart reporting for Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Again, that was Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Paul Smart reporting on Wednesday's protests in Albany about the recent murder of Dante Wright in Minneapolis.
On April 11th, Hudson Mohawk Magazine's roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry spoke to longtime activist Art Fleischner on the planning committee of the Capital District May Day events. In this labor talk segment, Willie and Art will talk about May Day's history in the Capital Region and upcoming events on May 1st.
This is Willie Terry, your roaming labor correspondent for the Hudson Mohawk Network. And today I have on the phone Art Fleischner, who's one of the key organizers of the Capital Region May Day events and activities. And he also is a member of the Solidarity Committee and Detroit Area Labor Council. And how you do, Art?
I'm doing well, Willie. Thanks for calling.
All right. Art, today we're going to talk about May Day, but it's a difference between May Day and Labor Day. So, Art, what is May Day?
Well, May Day is an American holiday that started about 140 years ago, 1886. Workers throughout the United States at that time were fighting to reduce the hours of work. Specifically, they were looking for an 8-hour day. Quite a few of them were working 12 and 14 hours a day. So they were looking to reduce the hours, and they decided, one group anyway, had a rally in Chicago on May 1st. And in other places as well, to emphasize that. There was some resistance from city authorities and police. And then when they got together again 2 days later on May 3rd to continue that struggle, some of the people were shot. Some of the demonstrators were shot. The next day, May 4th, workers got together again to protest the actions of the police. This was at Haymarket Square in Chicago. According to the story, someone had thrown a bomb into the midst of the demonstrations. And the long story is that seven people were arrested and charged with anarchy and murder. It ended up that four of them were hanged. One committed suicide. A couple had sentences reduced to about 15 years. And beginning at this time then, and I should mention also in Bayview, Wisconsin, I believe it was on May 5th, there was another rally for the 8-hour day, at which time I'm not quite sure the number, but there were several people at that rally killed. And these people in Bayview, Wisconsin, continue this celebration. I believe it's the first Sunday in May every year to remember that day. So beginning at that time and continuing up through the present, May Day was celebrated as a workers' holiday.
Mm-hmm. Now, Art, let me just ask you a question. May Day, you say, is an American holiday, but we have also Labor Day. That is a holiday where people get time off. Well, why don't we get time off for May Day?
Well, I believe it was in the 1890s that decided that this was not a good idea to have militant workers, not only in the United States, but in other countries as well, demonstrating for worker rights. And so they did create a Labor Day holiday in the first Monday in September, at which time employees would have the day off. And that was specifically to lessen the impact of May Day. And as we know, throughout the last 100 years or so, many countries around the world, many of them communists, socialists, and all, would have big parades on May Day, military might, workers marching and all. And so, again, that heightened the difference between countries around the world and the United States. And I might add, I believe it was under Lyndon Johnson, but I could be wrong about that, but they did create another holiday on May 1st called Law Day. And that was another effort to reduce the impact of worker solidarity, not only in the United States, but throughout the world.
Mm-hmm. May Day wasn't a thing of the Soviet Union or communists, but May Day was something that was started right here in this country. And somehow our country didn't adopt May Day, but the countries of the world did adopt May Day, huh?
Yeah, that was official government policy. But I should add that throughout all the last 140 years, there continued to be May Day rallies, some mm-hmm. of them quite large, mm-hmm. mostly in the larger cities of New York, Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland. But many other places as well would have annual picnics or parades or rallies or some celebration on May Day. And that never stopped since the 1880s.
Mm-hmm. And I know, Art, that the Capital District Solidarity Committee was one of the leading organizations here that pushed for May Day every year. Tell me a little bit about that.
We started 1983, and we did
Who's
have...
Who's the we? The Capital
we
District?
This is a group of labor representatives in the Capital District who supported the Greyhound strike mm-hmm. in 1983, and then continued to meet on a monthly basis to talk about other issues and put out our newsletter, Solidarity Notes. So we've been meeting all that time. And in the 80s and 90s, we did have a free Labor Day picnic, which we still do, right up till, we didn't do it last year because of the pandemic, but up till now, we've had a free Labor Day picnic in the Capital District. But also, in 1999, some of us in the Solidarity Committee said that we should emphasize the American holiday of May Day, and we should do something in the Capital District. So starting in 1999, we began having rallies, speakers, singers, free food, perhaps a movie, lectures, a march, a rally, different things all over the Capital District. And so for the last 22 years or so, we have celebrated something sometimes one day, sometimes 2 days. Some years it was a three-day celebration of May Day, either in Troy, Albany, Schenectady, Cohoes, I think Green Island, all different places.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Art, now we're in 2021, and I know May Day is coming up. So what kind of activities and events are y'all planning this year?
Well, this year, May Day conveniently comes on a Saturday. We've always celebrated May Day, whatever day it was, during a week or a weekend, whatever day it was, we celebrated. But this year, it's a Saturday. And we're going to have a two-day celebration. Going to begin on Friday night, where we will have a Zoom conference with four speakers. Between 7 and 9, that'll be Friday, April 30th, and you can register for that. We're sending out posters and letters and emails and notifying people how to register, and that will be around the discussion of where does the working class in America go, and how does it move forward? And, of course, the recent election at Amazon in Alabama and the impending situation here in Albany at the medical center where the nurses have unionized 3 years ago but still don't have a contract. So that'll be part of the discussion, I'm sure. And then on Saturday, May 1st, there will be a rally at Albany Medical Center beginning at 1 o'clock. And that will last for a couple hours. And then we will march over to Washington Park, a short walk, where there will be a rally around the amphitheater there. There'll be some tabling, some speakers, some music, some poetry, and just the general discussion. People will all be masked, and hopefully they will observe social distancing as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had mentioned about the Bessemer Amazon struggle down in Alabama, and it just came out that the workers lost their vote to the Amazon company. So would there be some discussion around that on the Friday event?
Well, I don't know exactly what the speakers will say, mm-hmm. but I'm assuming we do have... Jaribu Hill, mm-hmm. who has committed to speaking on Friday night. She's the education director at the Worker Center mm-hmm. in Mississippi. And so I think she's well aware of what has gone on. And I would expect her to say some things. We have Michael Zweig, a well-known author, Monica Cruz, who was a journalist, international journalist, and Fareed Michelin, who is heading up the union organizing drive at Albany Med. So I would assume that that would be part of the discussion that night.
Oh, okay. Well, all right, we're kind of out of time, but is there anything else you want to tell us about May Day before we go?
No, I just hope that we have a great weather on Saturday, and I hope folks will be able to attend. It's always a fun time, and... will be an educational experience, and just we look to celebrate it and have a wonderful day.
And thank you, Art.
Talking to you.
Okay, and that's Art Fletcher, who's a coordinator for the Capital Region May Day events and programs.
Thanks to Willie Terry, our roaming labor correspondent, for his interview with Art Fleschner of the Solidarity Committee of the Capital District and New York Solidarity about the history of May Day labor celebrations and the day of events this May 1st in Albany.
For those just tuning in, I'm Gabe.
And I'm Bria Barthel. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
Food is considered a basic human right, but fresh quality food is sometimes viewed as a privilege. Amy Klein, Chief Executive Officer of Capital Roots, talks with HMM Sina Bazila Hickey about her session for the upcoming Sustainable Futures Conference, describing her organization's work on combating food deserts and other food justice issues.
My name is Amy Klein, and I'm Chief Executive Officer at Capital Roots. And we are a food access organization based in Troy, and we work throughout the entire Capital region to make fresh, healthy food accessible and affordable.
So how is making food accessible and affordable a topic that is related to sustainability?
Folks being able to, you know, provide for their own food access is critically important, especially when you are living in an urban space. Having the ability to, within your neighborhood, access your basic needs like food is a key element of a sustainable community. And we also work to build and manage neighborhood food gardens so that people can grow their own food. So it's really about providing the full array of services so that people can, you know, eat good quality food and get it in their neighborhoods.
How is Capital Roots remedying inequalities in access to nutrition? And how has your approach changed over the years of your organization?
We started out as a community gardening organization back in 1975, and we were created by Gardenway, the manufacturer of Troy-built rototillers here in Troy. And for about 25 years, we were exclusively a community gardening organization. And it's still a big piece of what we do today. We currently have 55 neighborhood food gardens where over 4,000 people are growing their own organic food in our community spaces. And about more than 15 years ago, we were seeing that the neighborhoods that we work in were losing markets, supermarkets. They were leaving the urban spaces and moving to the suburbs. And, you know, what that meant is that people were not having access to the full array of the market basket. And in particular, what they weren't having access to was fresh quality food. And for folks who, you know, don't have cars, have limited transportation, it's a, you know, concern. And this really was before the USDA had coined the term food desert, but we were seeing it firsthand. And because we worked with the communities, we knew that people wanted to eat quality food because they worked hard to grow it. And so we started thinking about ways that we could make quality food accessible and affordable in the same neighborhoods that we were currently working in. And so we began to experiment with a variety of food access programs, beginning most notably with our Veggie Mobile, which was the first mobile produce market in the country. There are many now that are modeled after the Veggie Mobile. And from there, we developed a whole array of food access programs that are based in the neighborhoods that we serve, mostly inner city neighborhoods, making fresh food affordable and accessible. And they're affordable because we don't mark up the cost of our food. Whatever we buy it for is what we sell it for. And we buy more than half of the food that we sell from local farmers. So it's really top quality stuff, and it gives everyone the ability to access really good quality food.
You mentioned you started out as a community garden. Was there a lot of pushback with fighting for plots of land to become reserved for growing vegetables and green spaces? Was it an easy thing to establish in the Capital Region?
You know, I wasn't around back then, but from what I understand of the origins of the organization, there was plenty of vacant land. Our founder, Dean Leith, just began tilling up spaces in here in Troy and starting community gardens. We didn't own those lands at the time, and so Many of the gardens were started and then were lost to development over time. We expanded into Albany because, as the story goes, Mayor Corning was interested in what the organization was doing here and asked if we could help and bring the community gardening program into Albany, and that's how the gardens spread into Albany. We became an urban land trust in the early 80s, recognizing the importance of creating permanent green spaces within our community gardening program. And so that is now a really important thrust of our community gardening program. We own many of the gardens that we operate so that they are permanently protected and will be forever used as community gardens.
And you mentioned that the grocery stores were following residents moving into suburbs. Is there another reason that we have a system of food deserts? And then in addition to that, the lack of nutrition education and unaffordable produce? Can you give, is there some understanding of how this system became to be so frequent?
Yeah, you know, I mean, supermarkets saw really the benefit in their business model being in superstores. You know, the model of your smaller market was no longer viable for an urban space because they couldn't earn the same price point in terms of their square footage that they could with a, you know, a superstore. And so the whole model for supermarkets really changed over the years, beginning in the really early 90s, where markets began to favor these superstores for, you know, their bottom line. And, you know, at the same time, small mom and pop shops closed up because supermarkets were more affordable. So you had that happening at the same time. And so that left urban communities primarily, but also rural communities without right-sized markets, grocery stores. And that's really how these communities came about, you know, that people call food deserts, in terms of, you know, having access to nutritious food. There are still, you know, plenty of markets available. It's just a matter of being able to get quality food into the markets. And, you know, it's one of the things that we do as an organization is we work with small convenience stores to enable them to sell fresh produce, because there's no reason why our small markets can't. It's just a matter of distribution and infrastructure for these small markets.
What does the Capital Region need to do differently in order to create more sustainable systems that are accessible for everybody?
I think first and foremost, people need to be thinking beyond the obvious solutions. We work on food, we work on, you know, community development from a standpoint of accessible communities, you know, beautifying communities, how people move about, you know, in non-motorized vehicles. But, you know, we need to be thinking more creatively about how people, we can create communities that don't necessarily look like the communities of the 80s and 70s. So, for example, the supermarket model, I really believe, is gone, is dead as far as urban spaces. And so instead of trying, you know, working really hard to try to get a supermarket back into our urban spaces, what can we do to work with the infrastructure that we have, or to have a right-sized market, you know, to create solutions with what exists within our environment.
The session that you will be leading at the Sustainable Futures Conference is Why Good Food Should Not Be a Privilege. Could you give a little preview of what this breakout session will be about?
You know, I think the notion really exists and has for a long time that, you know, good quality food really is a privilege that is for those who have access to the most resources. When you think of farmers markets and you think of, you know, that top quality, just picked food, that is often not thought about being afforded to people who are less resourced. And that shouldn't be, it shouldn't be a privilege. It should be an equally accessible option for everyone. And so that is, that's really the basis for what our organization is about and how we can level the playing field so that everyone has access to the same top quality food, regardless of where you live or what your socioeconomic status is.
What kind of work would you like to see come out as a result of the Sustainable Futures Conference?
The idea of the conference, of bringing together so many different thought leaders and people in the community representing different ideas around sustainability, I think that has the promise of really creating collaborations outside the normal workings of, you know, that most people, you know, connect with. And so I think that opportunity is really what this conference, for me, that's exciting, is that opportunity to work outside the norm.
That was Hudson Mohawk Magazine, Sina Basila-Hickey, speaking with Amy Klein of Capital Roots, a speaker at the Sustainable Futures Conference. Now on to one of the youth presenters at this conference.
Melissa Hoffman, a climate activist and student at Vassar College, is part of the Youth Congress presenting at the Sustainable Futures Conference. She recently spoke with the Sanctuary's Water Justice Fellows.
Hello, I'm Chansonique.
And I'm Genesis.
And we are the Water Justice Youth Fellows at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. This interview is a part of a series of interviews about the Youth Congress event at the Sustainable Future Conference,
which will take place online April 27th to the 30th.
Enjoy the interview.
Do you want us to enjoy the interview one more time?
Yes, we would like to.
Just that part. Just
okay.
Enjoy the interview.
To start off with, can you please introduce yourself?
My name's Melissa Hoffman. I am 21. I'm a student at Vassar College. I do work on campus related to fossil fuel divestment and like carbon neutrality. And I also do work off campus with like the Sunrise Movement and supporting anti-fossil fuel infrastructure campaigns in the Hudson Valley.
Can you explain a bit more like about your campaigns and what that is in general?
In the Hudson Valley, there's been a lot of new fossil fuel, specifically like fracked gas projects that have been popping up in recent years. And so there are a lot of different organizations working on campaigns to stop those projects from being constructed, as well as to also like decommission current ones. One campaign that I've been pretty active with is stopping the proposed expansion of a power plant called Danskammer. It's in Newburgh. The company's trying to expand it into like a full, like all day, every day of the year power plant, whereas now it's just operating a few days of the year. I have also been involved in like some direct action work, blockading the construction of this other power plant called Cricket Valley in Dover, New York.
So how do you hope, like with your campaigns and your work, how do you hope that it will affect the community?
As like a, I guess a college student that I don't like live in this area, I just like go to school here and I'm here to like help the local community as much as possible and do work that local people here need help with. And so I believe that stopping fracked gas and other fossil fuel projects is really important for improving the health of people here in the Hudson Valley, because air pollution can be pretty bad from all these different power plants. They emit a lot of really bad toxic chemicals, and some people in certain cities in this area are already facing health issues such as like asthma and other diseases from like polluted water, chemicals in their water, and also air pollution. And then also, I think just like a lot of people on the front lines of like fossil fuel, of the fossil fuels industries, like destruction, have to face have to deal with the most severe consequences of like climate change, such as like heat, stress. We know like as it's getting warmer, less people will have certain access to spaces to cool down. And it's also, climate change is also like impacting farmers and agriculture here. And that's a big issue. Yeah, I guess I see like my work is trying to support a fossil-free community as supporting like the health and well-being of people here.
So I know you're going to be at the Youth Congress later this month. Can you explain what the Youth Congress is in your own words?
Yes. So what I see it as is like a visioning session for people from a lot of different groups, like people that have been pretty well involved in like climate activism, or and including people that are just new to it or really interested in like climate justice. So it'd be a space for people to discuss a lot of like issues that are important to them, learn about what climate justice really means, learn about like certain terms and like receiving that political education in order to sort of understand the context in which we're doing activism and in which we're sort of living in, so we can better envision the world we want to live in and envision actions that we can bring back to our own communities to take and benefit people. I also just really hope to see it as a place where we can all like share ideas and like thoughts that we've been having and haven't really had another space to really like flesh those ideas out.
So what is your role in the Youth Congress?
I'm involved in helping plan like the structure of it, as well as like some of the political education we're going to do. And I will probably be facilitating some of the breakout rooms we'll have and some of the like sessions. I think I might also might give a little just like small speech about what I have done. Yeah. And then also like outreach and like inviting people to join.
So why do you think it's important that all these groups come together and share their ideas and knowledge?
I think it's really important for us as climate activists to know what other people are doing and what other people are interested in and thinking about. I think it helps re-energize everyone and all the work we're already doing to know that like other people are super excited about this work, because it can be really confusing to know what we should be doing, because there's just so many different things we could do and different directions we can take. And so I think it's important for groups to come together to have a foundation in creating our own values and what we believe in, learning from our past experiences, past work we've done, to better understand improvements we can make in the future. Yeah, I just think it's really useful to hear where everyone's coming from, hear challenges, and be really honest with each other about like what we're actually excited about doing versus like what we feel like we're supposed to be doing. So we can actually do work that's super impactful and effective.
Do you feel that more youth should be in like the activism world and fighting things like climate change and what you're fighting for with the fossil fuels and the power plants?
Yes, I definitely think it's super important for youth to get involved and learn about like issues in their specific communities, as well as like issues that are happening across the world and maybe how they're interconnected, because we're facing a really difficult, I think, living situation going forward. And I think it can be scary for a lot of people to like learn all this scary facts about what climate change is supposed to be. And I found for me, the best way to deal with all this is to organize and like learn about revolutionary organizing, because we can, if we're well organized and committed to this work, we can definitely make a significant impact. And it's always worth it to reduce suffering and any consequences of climate change as much as possible. And I think like youth have a specific or unique like role in this, because of we have the power, I think, to shape our futures if we work together.
One quick last question. So I do know you're still in college, so you may be unsure about what you're going to do next, but between like the next 5 to 10 years, are you going to continue fighting against power plants in different communities, or are you going to take a different route?
I definitely see myself as super committed to fighting the fossil fuel industry wherever I end up or whatever, in whatever context I end up doing, just because I believe that like dismantling the fossil fuel industry as soon as possible is essential to stopping climate change. I'm also very interested in like labor organizing. And so I think I would probably get more into that as well once I join like the workforce.
So that's all I had. Thank you so much for being here today and doing this with me.
Cool. Yeah, no, thanks for interviewing me.
You can register to attend the Youth Congress event at sustainablefuturesconference.com.
Tune in next week to hear another interview with more people contributing to the Youth Congress event.
That was Melissa Hoffman, who will be taking part in the Youth Congress on Climate Justice at the Sustainable Futures Conference from April 27th to the 30th. Find more information at www.sustainablefuturesconference.com.
Frequent listeners may remember that Edson Thevenin was killed by Troy Police Sergeant Randall French on April 17, 2016. This Saturday will be the 5th anniversary of his untimely death. Amani Olugbala and Angela Bilor spoke to producer Melissa Bromley about an event they are helping organize to honor his life and those of others.
Hey, I'm Amani Olugbala.
Hi, all. This is Angela Bilor.
And what brings you here today?
We are excited to be here to talk about this action that is happening on the 17th of April, Saturday at 3 p.m. We're going to be doing a number of things, but mostly honoring the life of Edson Thevenin, who was murdered by Troy police officer here 5 years ago to the day. We'll also be connecting that instance of police violence and the brutality that is inflicted on Black communities to a number of other local instances of violation of Black life as an opportunity as a community to come together to raise our voices against this continued destruction on Black communities and Black bodies, and also give an opportunity for us to heal together, to grieve together, and to vision a world where Black life matters and a city that isn't divided through racism and all the other divides that we see and we live within.
The event is called Spring Into Action, Flowers for Black Life. The idea is to both honor those whose lives have been taken, starting with that of Edson Thevenin for that day, and honoring those who have lived, who have survived, who are surviving. And the thought is to have a gathering, but also to bring flowers, stones, crystals, flags, other offerings as we gather to remember and make space, both to mourn and to celebrate and to honor.
Who are you hoping will come?
I think we're hoping everyone who cares about a city where all members of the city, all citizens of the city, all visitors of the city are safe. Edson was murdered on his way home from celebrating his brother's birthday. I have family members who don't live here. I want them to be able to come here and celebrate me and my life and be able to make it home safely. And so anyone who recognizes that is a disgusting, atrocious injustice to be lynched, essentially, and to not receive any kind of justice from this legal system. Anybody who can recognize that that is an issue should come. Anybody who is mourning and grieving, you know, we still have is the trial of Derek Chauvin still going on? Probably, while we have Daunte Wright's name just really fresh on our ears, in our mouths, and just still have yet to see any justice for Breonna Taylor. And like, really, we could spend this whole time listing folks across the country, across the world, and in our city who deserve better. And so anyone who recognizes that, anyone who has a heart, an ear, and some time and wants to be in community, we would like them to come out.
You were meeting at the at a real divide, a physical divide in the city, which is, you know, underneath the Hoosick Bridge, also known as the Collar Street Bridge. It is where Edson's life was taken 5 years ago. And it also is this physical marker of Hoosick Street that was built and built a divide in the city. And so by meeting at that point, you know, the hope is to reach people who are passing by, people who may not have known and will stop because they see it, people who have heard about it, but those who feel that they want to gather in this time where, you know, there's, as Imani said, there's so many things that, so many places where lives have been taken and justice has not been served. And so the hope is to gather and support each other and envision this world that can be, you know, celebrating, honoring, protecting, and loving all, and particularly Black life.
So you both, I believe, were part of the Reimagine group that the city council put together last year. And the city just filed their report in response to Executive Order 203 by Governor Cuomo tasking municipalities to look at embedded racism in police departments. Do you see this event as part of that larger story?
Yes and no. So we were convened in a committee that Sue Steele initiated.
City Council member Sue Steele.
Yes. And, you know, we didn't have much hope in that process to begin with. And we left it with just as little as we began with. That report is a sham. And, you know, a lot of people spend a lot of time sharing their views and their pains, their traumas, and they were not listened to, they were tokenized, they were diminished. You know, during that process, at every meeting, the mayor said, this is just the beginning of a conversation. So this, I think, rally is one to say, that was not the beginning of the conversation. You didn't even have the conversation. During that, you refused to say the name of Edson Thevenin in particular. And so we, 2 weeks out from that report being released, we're saying we are reminding the city of this life that was taken 5 years ago and how little you respect Black life by showing that you will not even say his name. So, yes, we can't separate it from that series of events that just happened, where the city, you know, basically invested very little time in thinking about possible reform and reinvention. But it is far, far beyond that.
For anyone who's listening who can't physically be there on Saturday but still wants to support, is there anything that they can do?
Yes. Folks can always send donations. You know, we've just seen right here in Albany, police officers taking on extreme tactics using pepper spray and what's the other one that they use, tear gas. All of these things have already been declared by the United Nations as weapons of war, but they're being used on citizens who are just exercising their right to protest. So we've seen things like that happen. So we're just trying to be prepared in the case that, you know, officers are taking out aggression on people who are just trying to come together, celebrate, honor, uplift, and just demand some kind of justice. And so we want supplies and, you know, we have to purchase things like water and, you know, making sure medics teams have everything that they need. But we're really not anticipating that kind of energy. We see Troy PD likes to, you know, engage in harmful behavior towards folks sometimes when there's less eyes on them. And so we're not really expecting too much, but we are making other kinds of purchases, like, you know, flowers and other kinds of things to honor folks at like these different altars we're going to make. We're hoping that folks just continue to stay informed and inform other folks about what's happening. What are some other ways you think people can support, Angela?
On social media, you can find Troy for Black Lives. You can also find Reimagine Troy New York for updates on future events during the summer. And yes, as Amani said, donations can be taken through Troy for Black Lives for this and for future events.
Yeah, we're definitely anticipating this to be a series of things. So folks should stay tuned.
In our last minute, is there anything I haven't asked you about that you think people should know?
You know, there's like so much history in Troy. So much of that history is about loss and trauma, but there is also a deep history of innovation, creation, abolition. And I think these series of events that go on throughout the summer is about looking at all of these layers and holding them together within us so that, as Amani said, we can deepen your relationship to the tremendous contributions that Black and Brown life has made in this country, in the city, in this world.
One thing I'm really passionate about right now is just like how Black lives will not matter in this country. Is really, we're talking about Black death, right? Why isn't Black death cared about, responded to? But, you know, Black lives, in my opinion, and many other people's opinion, won't matter until Black life is really respected, honored, valued, cherished. So that means, you know, not just like sham diversity efforts of just having more Black and Brown places, faces, and, you know, predominantly white and colonial spaces. It really means like valuing the philosophies, the arts, the contributions of Black life, and making sure that children in this city have opportunities, like somewhere, something to do. I'm from a place where there's so much to do for kids. There's really hardly anything safe, healthy, and wholesome in this city. And it just feels like so much is invested in those of us who are white and who have lots of money, but there is just a shadow over all the other parts of Troy. We also know that all these statistics say that there'll be less crime and less harm and less like horrible things happening if folks just had more light on their streets. Like, can we just get some energy and investments into people's everyday lives based on actual statistics that prove what will take care of people? And I just also can't believe that there's nowhere for folks to go or no help for folks to get in, like the response with the arson that happened recently in our city. I'm just used to, right, like places where there are more support for people to meet their basic needs. But Troy, consistently, we see how it is mutual aid and people taking care of people that are keeping people safe, and our government owes our people better.
Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Melissa Bromley brought us to that segment with Amani Olugbala and Angela Beeler, organizers behind the event Flowers for Black Life, to be held under the Hoosick Street Bridge at 3 p.m. this Saturday, April 17th.
And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Bria Barthel.
And I'm Gabe. Our engineer is Sina Basila-Hickey. Remember to tune in every weekday to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have any comments, suggestions, or to comment on our work, please email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in helping, just email us at info@mediasanctuary.org or join our weekly virtual Zoom meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. by sending an email requesting an invitation link to hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Thanks for tuning in. Come back next time for more news and